Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everybody. Okay, so tonight we will be studying Sutta number 48 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Kosambi Sutta. Okay, this sutta originates in a particular incident which took place at some point during the Buddha's ministry. It was a major event which almost led to a division, a very sharp division, almost a schism within the Buddha Sangha. So that the monks in a particular town, city, the city of Kosambi, had been divided into two factions which were in bitter conflict with each other. And so when we come to the opening of the sutta, it says that on that occasion, the bhikkhus at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. It literally means that they were stabbing each other with the tongues of their mouth, or with the swords of their mouth. Okay, what was the origin of this conflict? You think it might be a different interpretation of dependent origination, a different views about the right way of practicing meditation? No. The quarrel originated from a principle of etiquette in the toilet. You see, in country like India, even now in villages in Sri Lanka, maybe also in China, one doesn't have flush toilets the way we have in the West. But in the latrine, in order to remove the waste and to, well, one doesn't have toilet paper either, but after defecating, then one cleans one's behind with water and one's hand. And so there would be in the toilets or the latrines a bucket in which water is kept. And there would be a storage area in which water accumulates. And so when one wants to use the toilet, then one fills that bucket with the water and brings it to the latrine, and then one uses the water within the latrine. Now, there was a principle of etiquette laid down by the Buddha. When one uses the bucket from the latrine to gather the water for washing oneself, one either completely empties that bucket and then usually turns it upside down so any excess water will drip down, or else one fills it up to the brim for the next person to use. But one is not supposed to leave a residue of water in the bucket. Just not supposed to leave just a little bit of water. And now there were two, at this monastery at Kosambi, there were two eminent monks. One was a specialist in the suttas, another was a specialist in the vinaya, in the rules of discipline. Okay, now the monk who was the specialist in suttas went to the latrine. He used water, and he wasn't aware of this regulation, it seems. And so he left, when he finished, he left a little bit of water in the bucket and went out. And the next monk to use a latrine, to use that particular latrine, was the Vinaya specialist, who must have been either waiting outside or approaching. And so he saw the Sutta specialist leaving the latrine. And so the Vinaya specialist went into the latrine, and he saw that there was a little bit of water left. And so he thought that I have to speak to the Sutta specialist about this. And so after he finished using the latrine, then he went to the Sutta specialist and said, "Did you leave a little bit of water in the bucket in the latrine when you were finished?" The Sutta specialist said, "I did." Then the Vinaya specialist said, "Don't you know that that is a transgression of the rule?" And so the Sutta specialist said, "Oh, I wasn't aware of this. But if it is, then I'm willing to do the confession. This is a way that one clears oneself of transgressions. One makes a confession to another monk." Okay, and so the Sutta specialist was about to make the confession. Then the Vinaya specialist said, "Did you leave that water intentionally or unintentionally?" And the Sutta specialist said, "I did it unintentionally." And so then the Vinaya specialist said, "In that case, it's not an offense. You don't have to make a confession." Okay, afterwards, okay, at this point they parted. Then the Vinaya specialist went to his group of students and he said, "Do you know that famous preacher on the suttas, so-and-so? He committed an offense by leaving water in the bucket in the latrine." Okay, so then the students of the Vinaya specialist, when they were meeting with the students of the Sutta specialist, they said, "Your teacher is very careless and inconsiderate. When he was in the latrine, he left water in the bucket. And so he committed an offense, and he didn't want to confess it." Okay, the students of the Sutta specialist went back to their teacher and reported what they had heard from the students of the Vinaya specialist. And the Sutta specialist then said to them, "Well, when I was speaking with the Vinaya specialist, he told me that this was not an offense, that there was nothing to worry about, I have no need to confess it. And now he's blaming me for being inconsiderate, for committing an offense and being unwilling to confess it. So he must be a liar and a deceiver." And so the students of the Sutta specialist met the students of the Vinaya specialist and said, "Your teacher is a liar and a deceiver." And so the students of the two teachers were arguing with each other. Then each one had their group of lay supporters. And so the students of the Vinaya specialist reported to their lay supporters what the Sutta specialist had done, criticizing him. The students of the Sutta specialist reported to their lay followers what the Vinaya specialist had done, criticizing him. And so two factions had formed now. And then one thing led to another as more and more monks came to the monastery. Each would try to persuade the visiting monks to join their own factions. And so the arguments became sharper, more caustic, more almost violent and forceful, not with physical violence, but the language that they were using was becoming very rude and aggressive. And so in this way, this argument went on and on. And it's at this point that the sutta opens. Okay, so then one monk, now we're in paragraph 3, goes to the Buddha, and then he informs the Buddha of what has been taking place. And so the Buddha calls these monks First, he questions them whether this is true, the report is true. And then paragraph 5, he asks them whether when they become involved in such a bitter dispute, whether they are able to treat one another with loving kindness. And so they say no. Okay, and then the Buddha scolds them, reproaches them, reprimands them, and then he points out that this will lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. Okay, then in order to try to bring these monks together, these quarreling monks together, he teaches what are called the 6 principles of cordiality. We've come across these 6 principles in an earlier sutta that I explained, but we'll go through them again. Okay, what are these 6 principles of cordiality? The first is displaying what are called bodily acts of loving kindness towards one's companions in the holy life. Okay, now loving kindness is a quality of the mind. This is metta. But this quality of mind has to be shown in actions. And so when people come together, then they have to not only set up loving kindness in the mind, but they have to express this loving kindness through treating each other kindly, with kindness, with love, through their bodily actions. For example, in a monastery, if one monk is sick, then other monks might come to his room, clean up his room, take his robes and other clothing, if it has to be washed, wash the robes for him. If his bedsheet is dirty, they will come and take the bedsheet and wash it. If he needs medicine, they'll go and get medicine for him. They'll make sure that he takes his medicine. If there are older monks, younger monks will sweep his room, mop his room. If he has to go walking, say, to the alms hall to take his meal, they will lead him by the arm to the alms meal, prepare food for him and bring the food for him. Okay, so these are just a few ways in which one displays loving kindness through bodily actions. The second principle of cordiality, of love and respect, is verbal acts of loving kindness. Okay, verbal acts of loving kindness means speaking to others in ways that are gentle, cordial, friendly. For example, one asks about the health of somebody when one doesn't see him for a long time. One inquires about their health, about their bodily condition. If somebody does something good for oneself, one thanks them and expresses one's gratitude. If, say, one monk gives a discourse, other monks might express their appreciation for the discourse. Okay, so these are just a few examples of verbal acts of loving kindness. And it's said of both the bodily acts of loving kindness and the verbal acts of loving kindness that these are to be formed both in public and in private. That is, when there's many people around, one will still show acts of loving kindness towards another person through helping them through bodily action. And then in private, when there might just be yourself and the other person, still you help that person through bodily action or through kind and cordial speech. Sometimes people will show loving actions through bodily action and speech in public when there are many people around. But when one is in a private place, then one completely neglects the other person, speaks to them rudely, harshly, impolitely. But according to this advice, the bodily actions, the verbal actions of loving kindness have to be practiced both in public and in private. The third principle of cordiality, of harmony and respect, is to maintain mental acts of loving kindness. It's said both in public and in private, but I don't know how one practices mental acts of loving kindness in public. Well, maybe perhaps the idea is that when there are many people around, one is thinking of the other person with loving kindness. But developing mental acts of loving kindness is really, it's a private action, something that one has to do inwardly. And this is done through the development of loving kindness, the meditative development of loving kindness. And so no matter what meditation subject one might be using as one's primary meditation subject, mindfulness of breathing, contemplation of sensations, vipassana, it doesn't matter. But from time to time, preferably every day, just for 5 or 10 minutes, one should do the meditation on loving kindness. And one extends the loving kindness, first of all, to oneself. Then one can choose the people who are living in the facility where you are living. If you're living at home, you choose your family. In the monastery, we choose the fellow monks, fellow nuns in the monastery, and we generate and radiate loving kindness towards the people who share our living quarters. And so when we make this a regular practice, then it becomes very hard to sustain anger and ill will over a long period. Even though sometimes we will have little quarrels and disagreements, but then when we go into ourselves and then think of the other people with a mind of loving kindness, then we realize that this anger and ill will that we might be bearing towards them is pointless and futile. It doesn't benefit ourselves, doesn't benefit others. And so we then can drop that anger and we develop a sincere wish for the well-being and happiness of others. And then by developing loving kindness in this way, maybe the next day when we meet the other people, might offer an apology for our behavior, and then we reconcile ourselves to the other person, and then we can live together harmoniously. So these are the first three principles of cordiality, of harmony and respect. That is bodily acts, verbal acts of loving kindness, and the mind of loving kindness. Okay, now the fourth principle of cordiality is to share things with other people. And this is especially pertinent in the monastic life, where ideally when one becomes a monk, one gives up all personal possessions and one is just supposed to live with the simplest requisites. The monastics, we can say, are the true communists in that they don't have private belongings, private property, but we share everything in common with the other monastics. So the only things that we can say are truly our own would be the basic requisites like the robes And then maybe little things like books, maybe a clock. And nowadays a computer. Okay, but everything else, whatever we obtain, we share with others. And so the Buddha says that the monk uses things in common with his virtuous companions in the holy life, and then whatever gains he makes, he shares them with the others without any reservations, without holding anything back. And that includes even the contents of the alms bowl. And so monks go, in order to get their food, in an Asian Buddhist setting, especially in the southern Asian countries, the monks go on alms round with their bowls. They go from house to house, just standing quietly in front of each house. And then people who have faith and devotion towards the Buddha Dhamma will come and they'll make offerings. And so it could happen that because the monks will go to different areas, in some areas people are expecting them, prepare food, and so they will fill, the monks will get a full alms bowl and they'll have more than enough food for themselves. Some other monks might go to an area where people are not expecting them, and so they will get just, you might call this, scraps of leftover food from the day before. In Sri Lanka, when we would go on alms round to places where we're not expected, the usual gathering is bread and these little bananas. And so that would be the typical unexpected alms collection. That would be the main meal for the whole day, just bread and banana sandwiches. Banana sandwiches, the bananas, little bananas put in between the slices of bread. But when there's a monastery where many monks are living together, when they come back from the alms round, they empty the contents of their alms bowl into large containers, and then they can take from the containers into their bowl whatever food they want. And so in this way, everybody gets enough. So this is sharing things in common with one's fellows in the spiritual life. And this principle one could also apply to some extent in household life. Instead of hoarding one's wealth and just clinging to it in a miserly way, one should make it a principle to donate a particular percentage of one's wealth to worthy causes in order to help other people. We have to reflect especially on the vast differences in income levels between what we call the developed world and the developing world, and think about the large numbers of people who are living in poverty in this country and other countries. And then we should make it a principle, a kind of guiding principle, to try to help others in any way we can by sharing our own earnings with them, at least a particular percentage or a particular amount to the best of our ability. Okay, so this is sharing things in common with others. The fifth principle of harmony and respect is dwelling both in public and in private, possessing in common with one's fellows in the holy life those virtues or precepts that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, not clung to, and which are conducive to concentration. Okay, so this means in regard to the monastics, it means observing the precepts together, observing the same code of precepts. And then when we have the description of these precepts, we say the important phrase that these precepts are not misapprehended, which means that they're not clung to. Not clung to with the idea or view that just by observing these precepts, one is able to gain liberation. But rather one follows these precepts as a basis for one's spiritual development. And then that's indicated by the next phrase, conducive to concentration. That is, these precepts are conducive to samadhi, to the collecting of the mind. And so this is why the Buddha has laid down these precepts, because by observing them, one restrains the unwholesome tendencies of the mind. And then through restraining the unwholesome tendencies of the mind, one is able to collect the mind and keep it focused, pure, settled on a meditation subject. Then the sixth principle of cordiality, of harmony and respect, is holding the right view. And so this is described that the monk dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating, and which leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. Okay, the words here are very important. Yeah, this view is described as the Aryan right view. This is the right view of the noble ones. It's the unique right view. It's not just the right view of karma and its fruits, but this is the view that is held by the noble persons. And this is the view that's Nyanika, which means literally it's the view that leads outward, that leads out from samsara, from the round of becoming, the round of birth and death. And then it leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. And so this right view becomes the forerunner and key factor in the development of the whole Noble Eightfold Path for reaching complete liberation of suffering. For this reason, because that view is so important for gaining final liberation, after the Buddha sums up these six principles of cordiality, in paragraph 7, he then goes on to give special emphasis to this factor of right view. He says, of these six principles of cordiality, the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying is this view that is noble and emancipating, and which leads the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. And then he uses a simile to illustrate this. In India, it was common to build houses with a peaked roof. All the different rafters of the house come up to a peak, and then there's a particular part which is put on the peak of the roof, which holds all of those rafters in place so that because of heavy rains and strong winds, and the pressures of time, distortion of wood, and so on, that those other rafters will not become bent and twisted and fall apart. And so that piece on the ferry top is called the roof bracket or the pinnacle, which holds all of the other, which holds all of the rafters in place. And so the Buddha says, of the six principles of cordiality, the chief, the most cohesive, the unifying, is this factor of the noble view. Now, starting in paragraph 8, the Buddha goes on to explain how this view that's noble and emancipating will lead to the complete destruction of suffering. Okay, first he takes the case of... Well, before I come into this, I want to raise the question, who is it that has this right view? Who is the person that's going to be described here? And the way I would understand this, based on the rest of the sutta, this will be a person who has reached the path leading to stream entry. It's not yet the sotapanna, not yet the stream enterer, but it is the person who has stepped beyond the plane of the ordinary people, the common people, and entered onto the path to the first stage of enlightenment, but has not yet reached even the first stage of enlightenment. So this is a person on the path to stream entry. So that person has acquired the Noble Eightfold Path. The person is on the path and is bound to follow the path through to liberation. But the person has not yet made the first breakthrough to realization. Okay, so now the Buddha is describing the way this person practices with the guidance of this right view. Okay, so now he says that he's talking about a monk who's gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut. These are the places for meditation. And this monk reflects thus, is there any obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know or see things as they actually are? Okay, now the Buddha will go on to explain what is meant by the obsessions. Here the word used in Pali is pariyutana. The English word obsession might be a bit too strong. The word pariyutana suggests a defilement which has been lying latent within the mind. But then through different external stimuli, this defilement can be provoked so that it comes into a state of activity. It rises up in the form of thoughts and emotions. And when it reaches that level, then it's called pariyutana. Call it obsession or even manifestation. So now we have the monk who is reflecting, examining his own mind, And he's asking whether he has any of these defilements that might so overwhelm his mind that he cannot see things as they really are. And so the answer comes that if the monk, now the Buddha will show what are the obsessions. So if the monk is obsessed by sensual lust, then his mind is obsessed. If it's obsessed by ill will, by sloth and torpor, by restlessness and remorse, by doubt, then his mind is obsessed. Okay, I think all of you will recognize what is this particular set that has just been enumerated. What is it? It's the five hindrances. Okay, then the Buddha adds, or the text adds, two other factors, which seem a little bit unusual here. If a bhikkhu is absorbed in speculation about this world, his mind is obsessed. If he's absorbed in speculation about the other world, then his mind is obsessed. And then the Buddha adds the factor which was the immediate occasion for his giving this discourse, that is, these quarrels and disputes. So if the monk is engaged in quarreling and brawling and is deep in disputes, then his mind is obsessed. Okay, now he comes back to this disciple, and he says that this disciple understands thus. There is no obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know and see things as they actually are. My mind is well disposed for awakening to the truths. Okay, this is a very important, we could say a very weighty statement. Now, the way I would understand it, in the case of a disciple who is just on the path to stream entry, it doesn't mean that his mind is completely free of the five hindrances. In fact, at the stage of the path to stream entry, this disciple will still be vulnerable to all five of the five hindrances. Those hindrances can rise up from time to time, and when they rise up, they will be a barrier to that disciple. But because this disciple has now acquired the Noble Eightfold Path, he's able to deal with those hindrances and keep them under control. He has the right view, so he knows that these states of mind are truly hindrances. He knows how to apply right thought, right effort, right mindfulness to overcome and to eliminate those hindrances. And because he's practicing in this way, he realizes that he is able to see things as they actually are. And then by making the appropriate effort, he will be able to develop the insight knowledges in order to contemplate things correctly and properly. And so the next sentence says, my mind is well disposed for awakening to the truths. It says, supanihitang me manasang satchanang bodhaya. Okay, the Satchanang here is the word which means truths. This is referring to the four noble truths. And the fact that the word Bodhaya is used, which means awakening or becoming enlightened to, this indicates that at this stage, the disciple has not yet awakened to the truths. It's when he awakens to the truths that he becomes a stream enterer. The stream enterer is one who has gained the Dhamma eye, the vision of the Dhamma, by awakening to the Four Noble Truths, seeing all Four Noble Truths. And so this disciple, so the disciple at this stage, hasn't yet awakened to the truths, but he's reached the path leading to this awakening to the truths. And so all he has to do now is to develop those path factors. And that, according to the other, another sutta, he is bound to awaken to the truths within that very same lifetime, that he cannot pass away without reaching the first stage of enlightenment. Okay, so now the Buddha says of this knowledge, he says, this is the first knowledge attained by him that is noble and super mundane. It's a world-transcending knowledge, a kind of knowledge that leads to liberation. And it's a knowledge which is not shared by ordinary people. People who are called Putujanas. This is the ordinary or worldly people. So according to the Buddhist teachings, all human beings can be divided into these two groups. One are the Aryans, the noble ones. Those are the people on the fall into the eight classes, the four pairs of call these four pairs of noble persons, the stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, arahant. And then the people on the four paths leading to those stages of realization. So those are the noble ones. And then everybody else is called an ordinary people, Putujanas. So this disciple is one who has this first knowledge, which is Aryan, a noble knowledge, and that qualifies this person as a noble individual, one who has risen up beyond the level of the Putujanas, the ordinary people. Okay, now we come to the second knowledge of this person. Here, the noble disciple considers thus, when I pursue, develop, and cultivate this view, do I obtain internal serenity? Do I personally obtain stillness? Here, interestingly, this is an interesting point. The word that's translated still serenity here, internal serenity, is samatha. And then the word translated stillness is nibbuti. And normally, when we speak about the two types of meditation, samatha meditation, well, normally when we speak about meditation, we make a distinction between samatha meditation, serenity meditation, and vipassana meditation, insight meditation. And it seems like these are two quite different systems of meditation. And then we have quarrels. Do you have to develop jhana to fulfill serenity? Can you just practice vipassana, and so on? But this text speaks about obtaining internal serenity through the cultivation of this view. So it seems to me, this is my understanding, that one uses this right view in order to develop insight knowledge, very clear and sharp insight knowledge. And then through the development of the insight knowledge, the mind becomes calmer and collected. And so one then enters a state that one can call internal serenity or inner stillness. But that inner serenity, that inner stillness, is the result not of practicing the normal samatha type of meditation, but through the development of insight knowledge guided by this noble right view. That's my interpretation. Okay, so this is the second knowledge attained by him that is noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. Okay, next, a noble disciple considers thus, is there any other recluse or Brahmin, ascetic or Brahmin, outside here? The text uses this phrase, ito bahida, which means outside here. And this is a kind of code term for outside the sphere of the Buddha Dhamma, who possesses a view such as I possess. And then when he raises that question, the knowledge comes to him. There is no other ascetic or Brahmin outside here possessed of a view such as I possess. Okay, so this seems to be indicating probably the special knowledge of insight particular to the Buddha's teaching. This would be the knowledge of the three characteristics, the knowledge of impermanence, dukkha, suffering, and non-self, the view of dependent origination, and the view of the Four Noble Truths. He's not yet had the actual awakening to the Four Noble Truths, but he has the right view of the Four Noble Truths. And he realizes that these aspects of this right view are unique to the Buddha's teaching and not found in their fullness outside the Buddha Dhamma. So that is the third type of knowledge that he attains, again, which is noble and supramundane. Okay, now the next knowledge pertains to this person's character. And so the disciple questions himself, do I possess the character? The word that's used here is the word dhammata. So my translation of character is something of an interpretation. We could say the nature or character. Okay. okay, do I possess the character of a person who possesses right view? And what is the character of a person who possesses right view? Okay, now the Buddha will describe that character. It's the terminology is a little technical. I'll explain it after I read it. Although he may commit some kind of offense for which a means of rehabilitation has been laid down, still he at once confesses, reveals, and discloses it to the teacher, that's the Buddha, or to wise companions in the holy life, that is fellow monks. And having done that, he then enters upon restraint for the future. Okay, now what's meant by an offense of a kind for which a means of rehabilitation has been laid down? Now, in the Buddhist monastic code, there are two kinds of rules. One kind of rule is called parajika. This is, you might call this expulsion offenses. If one commits that kind of offense, one has to be expelled from the monastic order. And there are four expulsion offenses. One is to engage in sexual relations. Second is to steal an item that's worth a particular amount such that one can be subject to legal punishment for it. The third is to take a human life or to participate in taking a human life. And then the fourth is to make false claims to super normal attainments, to higher spiritual attainments. Okay, now, a noble person will never commit one of those types of offenses. That is impossible. But the other types of offenses have different means, a kind of penalties that one has to go through or processes, and then one is rehabilitated. Most of them require simply confession to another monk. Okay, so that is the means of rehabilitation. Okay, so if a person who is a noble disciple like this, one with this right view, if this person commits an offense of one of these lesser categories, then he will not hide it and conceal it and keep it within himself, but he will feel shame and regret for that transgression. And then just naturally, through his desire for purification, he'll confess it to another monk and then enter upon restraint in the future. And then the Buddha illustrates this with the example of an infant lying on its back, and then it might put out its hand or foot towards a hot coal. And when it feels the heat, it will immediately pull back. And so it's in the same way this person who might commit one of these minor transgressions will confess it and then enter upon restraint for the future. And that is intended to illustrate the character of that person. Okay, the next knowledge also illustrates the character of this person. Here, the noble disciple reflects, do I possess the character of a person who possesses right view? Again, what is that character? Even though he may be active in various matters for his companions in the holy life, yet he has a keen regard for training in the higher virtue, the training in the higher mind, and the training in the higher wisdom. Okay, now, it sometimes happens that a monk, okay, some monks will take to this higher training and go off and devote themselves to intensive meditation practice and to develop wisdom. But other monks will be involved in a fair amount of community service. For example, in a monastery, there are various tasks that have to be performed, especially in the larger monasteries in the Buddha's time. There would be one monk who's in charge of meal arrangements, another monk in charge of arranging lodgings for visiting monks, another monk in charge of maybe the cleaning of the grounds. And so there are different duties that have to be undertaken, different chores that have to be managed. And so there could be some monks who, by their temperament, become actively engaged in these duties. But this text points out that even though a monk is active in these various matters for his companions in the holy life, still he'll always be thinking about training in the higher virtue, training in the higher mind, training in the higher wisdom. He'll be quite scrupulous in observing the precepts, and whenever he has the opportunity, even if it's for short periods, he'll go to develop the mind in samadhi, concentration, and in vipassana and panya, in wisdom. Then the Buddha illustrates this with the example of a cow. A cow has a new calf, and yet the cow has to eat, and so the cow will be grazing. But while the cow is grazing, the cow will be constantly looking over to the side to look at its calf. And so in the same way, this disciple who is doing things, actively working in the different tasks of the monastery, helping his fellow monks, will always have his eye, at least one eye, fixed on this higher training. Naturally, he'll be regarding the training in the higher virtue, but he'll always have a great deal of respect for developing the mind in concentration and for developing the higher wisdom. Okay, so this is the fifth knowledge that is noble and super mundane. Okay, then we come to the sixth knowledge. And this one is concerned with what is called the strength or the power of a person who possesses right view. Okay, so what is this strength? When the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, he heeds it, gives it attention, and engages it with all his mind, and then he listens to the Dhamma with eager ears. Okay, so this shows the high regard that this disciple has for the Dhamma, that when the teaching is being proclaimed, then he listens to it, even though he already has the right view, so he doesn't have to learn anything else in order to gain that world-transcending right view. But still, out of his respect, love, and interest in the Dhamma, when the Dhamma is being taught, he'll attend very carefully, especially when it's being taught by the Buddha himself. He'll listen, engaging it with all of his mind in order to absorb this Dhamma teaching. So that shows this. For some reason, this is called the strength of the person. Okay, and that is the sixth knowledge. And then we come to the seventh knowledge. Okay, a noble disciple considers thus do I possess the strength of a person with right view? Again, this is concerned with strength or power. Okay, so what is that strength or power? When the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, he gains inspiration in the meaning. He gains inspiration in the Dhamma. He gains gladness or joy connected with the Dhamma. Okay, the operative word here is the word Veda. We have these two expressions, Atta-Veda, Dhamma-Veda. Okay, this word Veda, it sort of brings together two ideas which in English or in our way of thinking are usually distinct, but somehow they're both connected with this word Veda. One is the idea of knowledge or understanding. The other is the idea of feeling, emotion. And so through understanding, there arises a particular kind of feeling or emotion. This is the feeling or emotion that one gains when one understands that which is ultimately true, ultimately valuable. And so as he listens to the Dhamma, heeding it, absorbing it, understanding it, then there arises this feeling of, maybe we call it a feeling of inspiration, which suffuses the whole person. This inspiration that comes, this inspiration, elation, upliftment that comes from understanding the teaching, and from understanding the meaning, the goal, or the value to which the teaching points. And so this is the inspiration in the meaning, the inspiration in the Dhamma, and then as one gets this inspiration, then there comes, gladness is a weak word, pamoja is a joy, kind of uplifting joy. And this is the joy connected with the Dhamma. Okay, so this illustrates the strength of this person with right view. And that is the seventh knowledge attained by him. When he understands he possesses this, that is the seventh knowledge attained by him. Okay, now the Buddha makes a statement to conclude this discourse. I find this a little bit problematic. I have to confess that I don't quite fully understand it. But I'll give my explanation. Okay, he says, when a noble disciple is thus possessed of seven factors, he has well sought the character. And here the word again is dhammata. Well sought the character for realization of the fruit of stream entry. The way I understand this, it seems to be saying that the person who possesses these seven factors has a suitable character for realizing the fruit of stream entry. which implies that he hasn't yet realized it. Doesn't that doesn't this statement suggest that to you? In fact, the Pali uses sotapatti pala sacchikiriyaya. Sacchikiriyaya, this is what we call in Pali grammar the dative of purpose, which means it shows a purpose to be achieved. And so if there's a purpose to be achieved, that means that one hasn't yet achieved that purpose. It's something that one has to accomplish, that lies ahead in the future. And so it seems that these are seven knowledges that will bring, or set these seven knowledges that are seven factors that constitute the character of that person. And when a person has that character, he or she is capable of realizing the fruit of stream entry, but not yet possessing that realization. But then the next sentence says, when a noble disciple is thus possessed of seven factors, he possesses the fruit of stream entry. Sotapattipala samanagato. So, when we take both sentences together, the first suggests the person has the right qualifications for attaining the fruit of stream entry. The second seems to be saying that the person already possesses the fruit of stream entry. There seems to be a bit of a contradiction there. I don't know how to resolve it. I checked the commentary. The commentary didn't offer any help. And so we just have to leave it at that. Leave it with that ambiguity. Okay, at this point, I'll ask if there's any questions on anything that we've covered. Okay, Victor.
Bhante, the sharing aspect of it, would that also involve the sharing of ideas, not material things?
It could also include the sharing of ideas.
Because that would also help someone along.
Exactly, yeah.
Them gaining wisdom.
Yeah,
insight.
Yeah, yeah. So the way, of course, the way it's phrased here with regard to the monastic life, it's phrased in terms of sharing material gains. But we could take the idea of sharing in a very broad way, which will also include sharing ideas that would come out in discussions.
Would that also then explain, for want of a better term, a symbiotic then relationship between the Sangha and the laity? Because the Sangha would then share their knowledge.
That's a very, very good point. In fact, there are other suttas which speak about that symbiotic relationship, whereby the Buddha says that, to addressing the monks, he says that monks, these lay people, provide you with your robes, your alms food, your dwelling places, and your medicinal requisites. You should provide them with this Dhamma teaching that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. I think, George, you had...
Yeah, I was wondering about path and fruit.
Yeah.
Usually, I read the fruit is almost instantly following the path. But here, there seems to be separation.
Yeah, okay, this is a good point. There seems to be a different, what I would call a different presentation in the relationship between path and fruit in sutta teaching and in Abhidhamma the Abhidhamma, and the commentaries are based on the Abhidhamma. And so what we call mainstream Theravada Buddhist teachings now are based largely on the commentaries, and the commentary in turn is based on the Abhidhamma. But as I said, there's a different presentation or difference in presentation between sutta and the Abhidhamma commentarial presentation. I don't know that they're necessarily incompatible. In the sutta presentation, what is said is that when one enters the path, or when one reaches the path, one is incapable of passing away without attaining the fruit, which implies that there can be some time gap between reaching the path and realizing the fruit. There are other suttas in which, in the Anguttara Nikaya, a householder is saying that this is a householder who has abhinya, supernormal powers, so that he could know the level of realization of of different monks. And so he says when he's offering alms, he knows that this monk is an arhant, this monk is a non-returner, this one is once-returner, this one is a stream-enterer, and this one is on the path to stream-entry. Okay, now if the path to stream-entry was just one mind moment, which is said to be a millionth time in the snap of a finger, one couldn't really offer alms to a person in that in that duration of time. So the commentary to get around that says what happens is he's offering alms to somebody, and then just as he puts the alms in that bowl, just as he puts the alms, the food, in that person's bowl, that monk is looking at the food, contemplating it as impermanent, suffering, non-self, and then he reaches the path to stream entry, which is not very convincing. Okay, so if we take the sutta way of presentation, it seems that there is that one is on the path for a certain duration of time. According to the Abhidhamma position, you see, what the Abhidhamma does is to analyze experience into very, very, down to very, very subtle levels of detail. And so the Abhidhamma describes the different states of consciousness that arise in the process of attaining stream entry. The way I would try to bring these two together, what I would say is that the sutta presentation is correct in that at a certain point in time, one enters upon the path, one gains the factors of the path that are going to lead definitely to realization, so that one has to reach realization, achieve realization in that very life. Okay, once one gains the path in that sense, one cultivates the path factors. As one is doing so, one is strengthening the mental faculties, the spiritual faculties. And then those spiritual faculties will reach a certain point at which the breakthrough takes place to the understanding, that awakening to the truths. That awakening to the truths, that is what I would say is the path that's described according to the Abhidhamma method. And then that is followed immediately by the fruition stage. And so what is called the path, entering the path in the sutta presentation, is not the same as what is called the path moment in the Abhidhamma commentarial presentation, but rather the path moment in the commentary, or the path experience in the Abhidhamma commentarial presentation, that is the climax or culmination in the development of the path that is presented in the suttas. That's the way I would bring the two together. Any further questions? Okay, go ahead.
Earlier, you referred to speculation about
probably it would be, you know, there are set or fixed formulas of the different types of speculative views that were being discussed in Indian religious circles during the time of the Buddha. Questions like, is the world eternal, not eternal? Is the world boundless in space or bounded? Is the soul the same as the body or different from the body? Does an enlightened or liberated person exist after death, not exist after death, both exist and not exist, neither exist nor non-exist? And then many variations on those views. It probably refers to those views.
And the other world? What would the other world?
Well, it would be like the views when one passes away, does the self, there would be speculations in terms of the self. Is the self infinite or finite? Is it measurable or measureless? Is it blissful or pain? Does it experience bliss or pain? That's what I would assume that it means. It could also refer to that. Yeah, there's a list of speculations like that in Sutta number 2. Okay, I think we will have to conclude for the evening. So we end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, we share the merits with the Devas, the Nagas, the Bhutas, wishing them to rejoice in these merits, by so rejoicing to protect the Dhamma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.